the unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science.
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to Journey 127 of the Journey Into podcast, featuring Evermore, I Told the Raven by Ken Scholes. I'm your guide on this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from base camp in Halifax, Oregon. Yeah, that's it, Halifax, Oregon. This is an exciting episode for me to present to you. It is the fulfillment of several things that I've been trying to do on this podcast. One of them is to feature Edgar Allan Poe, as I've done over the last three or so years with an Edgar Allan Poe month. As you know, it's typically in January, which kind of commemorates his birthday. But for several reasons, I needed to extend that. So here we are in July doing Edgar Allan Poe month, which will also probably extend into August because of the various things going on right now. I guess also, if you're new to this podcast, you might not know the history of this particular story, but this year, in years previous, I've done a contest where I've asked people to submit stories to me with a Poe title. So I've done, like last year, we did a version of The Gold Bug. We did a version of Lygia. And also The Imp of the Perverse. And they were all different types of tales, and I really enjoyed last year's productions. And I've enjoyed all of them. The stories have been fun and have been rich and imaginative. But as you may or may not know, I decided to take it a step further this year and to ask Ken Scholes, a professional published author, to provide a tale based on a Poe title. And I ran a Kickstarter to fund it, and due to the great generosity of many donors, was able to fund that Kickstarter and be able to pay Ken to write this story for the podcast today. And I am indeed grateful to all those who donated to make this happen. And I'll be thanking you each specifically after the story here today. And I think that's as far as I'm going to go before the story. I really want to get this to you and let you hear Ken's great story. And we'll talk more about his inspiration and more about the Kickstarter and the future of this story and the future of the podcast after we listen to the story. So now, come with me and let's journey into shared histories and loss and the future. Somewhere in the Northwest United States.
Evermore I Told the Raven by Ken Scholes. It was the perfect day for a funeral. Grey with a promise of rain, mist ribboning around the headstones. And it was the perfect size. A small baker's dozen dressed in black, some with umbrellas and some without. No music, few words. I stood to the side and watched. When it was over, I walked back to my car. This was the first time I'd driven to Bradley. My last trip home had been by bus. Before that, I'd come by train, and in the early years, by wagon. But now I had been home for 2 hours, and I was ready to feel the highway mumble beneath me as I sped north and away. I climbed back into my rental after the graveside service. I'd always been out of place here, and felt it even more so now that he was dead. The youngest member of the funeral party separated from the rest. She was a woman, maybe 20, wearing a black vintage dress, all severe lines and lace. She approached my car. I willed myself to turn the key, fire up the engine, pull away. I'd come, I'd paid my respects, but she seemed intent on speaking to me, so I paused after sliding the key into the ignition. Then I sighed and rolled down the window. She stammered,
"Are you Thomas's brother?"
I looked at her over the rims of my sunglasses. "I am."
"He told me to keep an eye out for you. There's something for you back at the store."
She paused and I saw her cheeks flush with self-consciousness.
"I worked for him."
We'd started the store together, though he'd always known I'd be the one to wander off. First with the wars, and then with just the excitement of a world to see. And I'd stayed on the go too. My ship had only been in from Hong Kong 2 weeks when I got the call that my brother was gone. "What time can I meet you there?" She shrugged.
"You can follow me over now if you want. I'm opening late today."
She pointed to a red two-door.
"That's me there."
I nodded and waited while she climbed into her car. Then I followed her slowly out of the cemetery and onto the highway. I hadn't been home in decades, but despite the growth and sprawl, the downtown stretch was instantly familiar to me, and the corner building my brother and I had chosen so many years ago. The original sign had been meticulously maintained. Found Brothers. Books and sundries. I pulled up the front and she pulled round the back. I was waiting at the front door when the lights came on and she made her way through the stacks to let me in.
"I'm Victoria, by the way."
She extended a hand and I shook it, briefly. "Michael." She was staring at me and I tried not to notice. Instead, I glanced around the shop. It was more cluttered than I remembered it. Stacks of books and magazines colonizing the walking space between overstuffed shelves. Large tray tables filled with LPs or bagged comic books. The shiny metal espresso machine looked out of place in the room, but the purring cat in the window did not. Victoria turned the sign around.
"Would you like some coffee, Michael?"
I turned. "No, thank you." I shifted on my feet. Part of me wanted to stay and sift through what my brother had made of his life here. Part of me wanted to wander the streets that he and I had wandered during our childhood together here. Part of me wanted to get into my car and head back to Vancouver. There would be another ship to another place where I could vanish for a while and sort all of this out. So what did he leave for me? She dug around in a drawer behind the counter and pulled out a key ring. She handed it to me and I stared at it in the palm of my hand.
"What's the plan, boss?"
Now it was my turn to stammer. "Plan?" She nodded.
"It's your store now."
I shook my head. "I don't want it." I stretched out my hand, offering her the keys. "You take it." Now she snorted.
"I don't think so. I'm a worker bee, not a queen bee."
I looked at the keys in my hand. Was there a note or something to go with these?
He said there was a letter, but I couldn't find it.
I looked around the store. I can't imagine why. Even the counter was awash with papers. Newspapers, bills, notes, old magazines still opened to unfinished articles of great interest at some time. I sighed again. I guess the plan is that we clean up. I argued with myself about the plan as I set to work. It was at odds with the plan that had me back to Vancouver and shipping out within the next few days. Not that I had any idea where. Anywhere but here, I thought. We sorted the counter space and back office desk out in about 2 hours, moving things into piles, then reduced the piles to a single box of noteworthy items. It took 3 hours, and then we moved into the stacks of clutter in the front of the store. The crate was buried under a flat of LPs and stacks of old pulp magazines and National Geographics, When she saw it, Victoria clapped.
Oh, we wondered where it had vanished off to.
She pulled a claw hammer from the tool drawer and went to work prying the crate open. What is it?
An old statue he picked up at an estate sale.
He always talked about mounting it above the door.
But after he got it back to the store, he lost it.
I looked around the room we'd barely made a dent in. I wonder what other buried treasure will turn up. She lifted the statue up from the styrofoam peanuts it was packed in, grunting with the effort. It was a white statue of Pallas Athena. Of course it is, I said. And now I knew where to find the letter. I oriented myself around the shelves of the room until I found the classics. I pulled down a leather-bound edition of Poe's collected works and found his favourite poem quickly. The page was marked with a folded sheath of yellow papers. I unfolded it, suddenly eager to see what words he'd left for me. It was the copy of the deed to the store and the property it sat on. Well, I told her, this isn't it.
So, we'll continue our great quest tomorrow?
It's not what I wanted. I eyed my rental car through the shop's dirty front window, but the missing letter, more than the dead brother, stirred something inside me. I guess so. My uncertainty turned into resolve as I glanced again at the statue. Yes. Outside, the grey moved to a deeper shade of dark as the afternoon moved toward evening. The day had slipped past us, and we'd barely made a dent in the clutter that surrounded us. Victoria went to the counter and scribbled something down onto a sticky note.
Are you staying upstairs, then?
I hadn't thought about it. I figured I'd be back in Canada by now. The last time I visited, I'd only stayed a few hours and hadn't even gone up to the apartment my brother and I once shared, above the store we once managed together. I looked at the deed in my hands. I think so. She handed me the sticky note.
The key is on your ring. This is my number, if you need anything.
I took it from her and stuck it to the deed. Thanks, Victoria.
You're welcome.
She smiled, and it was a sad smile, her brown eyes soft with compassion.
I'm sorry about your brother.
Me too, I said, though it slowly dawned on me that I felt very little. Still, her eyes told me that she felt his loss deeply. I'm sorry for your loss, I mean. I saw the beginning of tears now as she tried to blink them away.
I only knew your brother for a few years, but you...
She took a deep breath and released it.
He was your brother.
Yes, I said. She kept watching me, and I suspected she was looking for a response beyond my words. I said nothing. The silence grew awkward, and she shrugged into her raincoat.
I'll see you tomorrow,
she said as she slung a tattered backpack over her shoulder.
I have class until 10.
Tomorrow, then, I said. I locked the back door behind her as she slipped out. Then I contemplated the stairs to the upper floor. I didn't want to make that climb. I felt the resistance in my bones. Instead, I scooped up my jacket and brought the copy of Poe with me as I slipped out into the late afternoon. I wandered the downtown sidewalks, familiar old buildings with new shops now. The old brothel was a Thai restaurant now. The old hardware store had reincarnated as a radio station, the disc jockey sitting in a glass window where passers-by could watch him work. He smiled at me as I moved down the sidewalk. I found a German restaurant where Dick's barbershop used to be and went inside. The Jägerschnitzel and Spätzle were as good as anything I'd had in Germany, and the beer was kellerkalt and sweet. While I ate, I read through Poe. Words had been my brother's favoured mode of experiencing the world. He'd been around the world once, a careful student, taking in his stops by book first, then going with a meticulous list of things to experience and see while he visited. But once around was enough for Thomas, and then he was back to his place on the stool behind the counter of the store. The one time I'd watched the store for him, the month he'd been in Paris, I nearly went crazy from sitting still for so long. The world, in my mind, was to be gulped on the run, letting each place surprise me with its people, its food, its customs. I didn't want to know in advance what I would see and do. I wanted to be ambushed by each place. We understood these differences in one another. More than that, we embraced them, and so I could be gone for decades and never once be shamed for my time away. And never once did I shame him for his time in that first home that had found and embraced us here in this place. I took a slice of apple strudel to go, the smell of baked apples and vanilla filling my nose as I left the restaurant. I walked back to the store past the lawn of the First Presbyterian Church. I paused as I stepped into the shadow cast by a statue. It was a bronze likeness of the man who was the closest thing we had to a father, and I looked up into his face. It was Reverend McKay, shrewd as a serpent and harmless as a dove, captured perfectly in the lines of his jaw and brow. He was with the hunters who found us, shivering from cold and fear on the side of the mountain, and brought us back into the fledgling town on the edge of the Cascades. He was the one who named us, the Found brothers, Thomas and Michael. And that last name stuck even after he adopted us. Seeing Reverend McKay brought back a flood of memory, culminating in his own funeral shortly after the turn of the 20th century. My brother and I knew by then that we were very different, that we didn't belong, but we'd yet to understand much. We still didn't, even all these years later. We knew we weren't from here. We knew we didn't age the same way they did. We also didn't get sick. We didn't experience humanity in the same way, despite looking the part. The Reverend's death had been one of those realizations early on to just how other than my brother and I were in the small town that had adopted us. The sky cracked open and the rain threw itself violently down around me. I moved quickly along the sidewalk and slipped into the back door of the shop, taking the stairs slowly up into my brother's apartment. I let myself in, leaving the strudel on the narrow counter, and making my way to the guest room I used the few times I'd visited here. The room was ready, and had been for some time. A thin layer of dust coated the desk, bureau, and nightstand. I took a cursory tour around the place, inhaling the smell of my brother and his things. It was a heavy, musty aroma. I sat, ate the strudel, and read more Poe. He loved his books, his world of words. I fished and hunted and found my peace in the forest or on the water, the real world in my mind. Still, the irony of the poem he'd marked was not lost upon me. A man up late at night, poring over his old books, seeking some truth in them that might assuage his suffering. And yet here I was, in my dead brother's home, reading his book, fresh from his funeral, and I felt nothing at all. No sorrow, no sense of separation, no tears. And yet today I was more alone in this world than I had ever been before. Eventually I took myself to bed and laid awake a long time wishing I felt something, anything, until I fell into a light and dreamless sleep. I was awake and walking the streets of my hometown long before dawn. The rain had let off, but the fog was heavy. I eventually found a bakery and sat in the park with fresh croissants and strong black coffee until the sun rose and the fog turned pink. I returned to the building and forsook the stairs in favour of the store. Victoria wasn't due in for another 2 hours, and I busied myself around the shop. My ambivalence was slowly becoming agitation, and the books and heady smell of paper felt like walls that threatened to collapse upon me. I was on a ladder, mounting a shelf above the door for the statue we'd uncovered, when I heard the doorknob rattle. I paused and glanced down. A middle-aged woman in a raincoat and holding a briefcase stared up at me through the door's glass window. "One minute," I said. I climbed down and moved the ladder, unlocking a door. The woman stared at me.
"Are you Michael Found?"
I nodded.
"You look much younger than your brother."
"Yes," I told her. There was no way I could explain that to her. He'd chosen to experience old age. I hadn't. Just like he'd chosen to stay in Bradley, and I'd chosen to stay on the road, or at sea, or up trail, or downstream, any place that wasn't standing still. She blushed and extended her hand.
I'm Sandra Matthews, from Matthews and Donaldson's.
I shook her hand. Yes, I knew your father.
Actually, my grandfather.
Again, I'd found that explaining rarely helped. Ah, yes, my mistake.
I saw the lights on and thought I'd stop by. I heard you were in town. I have some things to go over with you regarding your brother and the business at some point.
Mordecai Matthews had been one of Reverend McKay's strongest supporters. A deacon in the church and an expert marksman. He'd been with the Reverend on the day we were found, and when it became obvious that we weren't quite like our neighbours, his office became the keeper of our secret and the machine that kept our lives quietly possible. I'd be happy to meet and go over everything, I said. I paused and glanced from the statue to the ladder. Is there any chance that my brother left a letter for me in your care? Sandra shook her head.
Not to my knowledge, but I can go through the file to be sure.
I found myself wondering how big that file must be, given how far it went back. The Found brothers were easily their oldest clients. And Mordecai's granddaughter was processing that better than I expected. It was one thing to deal with a man my age by mail, as I'd done with their offices since leaving town so long ago. It was another to look me in the eye and see what made me different from her and the rest of her kind. Something quietly unsettling that Thomas had set about repairing, learning to fit in. I'd never seen the point. Of course, I'd not seen the point in staying here, or in growing old, or dying for that matter. But Thomas had, for whatever reason, and whatever message he might have had for me was most likely lost within the apocalypse of our bookstall. Sandra's card materialized, cream against the lighter cream of her hand.
Call me, and we'll set up an appointment.
I took the card and slid it into my shirt pocket. I will. She smiled and let herself out. I went back to the statue and the shelf I was hanging. I stood beneath its stair when Victoria's keys jangled in the back door.
It looks good.
She dropped her backpack behind the counter. That's where he wanted it? I'm not sure why it had become so important to me, but it had. More urgent in the moment than even the letter. Still, that urgency was at least some kind of emotion. I glanced at Victoria.
Yep, that's even the shelf he picked out for it.
We were the Found brothers. We could finish one another's sentences and one another's projects. It was part of why not finding his last words to me was so perplexing. I found it in the back room, I said. I found the screws in the drawer. Victoria hung her coat.
Well, you're off to a good start. What's next?
We spent the morning making more of a dent into the store, getting books up onto shelves and out of the way. She started a box of free books to put on the sidewalk, weather permitting, and I focused on going through the scattered apocalypse of loose paper. Bills, receipts, notes, requests, doodles, forgotten napkins stained with petrified bits of jelly. And after another full day, this time the dent much more noticeable, I still had nothing from him. I felt the tickles of panic and wondered at it. I should feel sad or lost. It's how I felt when the Reverend died. But all I'd felt so far was urgency that now balanced on a sharp edge of fear. And yet, it still didn't feel as if he were gone. We closed up and Victoria waited by the door.
How are you doing?
She asked. The question surprised me, and I didn't want to answer. I'm fine, I said. She nodded.
You're probably still in a little bit of shock over it all.
I shrugged. Probably. She put her hand on the doorknob.
So, tomorrow then?
Yes, tomorrow. Victoria reached out and squeezed my shoulder.
We'll find the letter. I'm sure of it.
I offered a weak smile as she slipped into the dark. I stayed in that night and went to bed early, but sleep evaded me, and at 10 minutes to midnight, I turned on the lights to the shop below and sat in the overstuffed reading chair we'd discovered earlier that day beneath a mountain of books. I opened the copy of Poe and glanced at the statue. The pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. I read the words and smiled. Then I settled into the chair and read until the dull chime of midnight made me jump. I chuckled at myself. But I didn't jump at all when I heard tapping at the door. Between the book and the bust, I wasn't surprised. And it explained why I didn't feel as alone in the world as I should have. I stood up, put down the book, and went to let my brother in. He hopped into the room with many a flirt and flutter, and I locked the door behind him. Papers ruffled as he flapped his wings and launched himself toward the ceiling, finally settling onto the statue.
"Ta-da!"
quoth the raven. I shook my head and chuckled again. "Hello, Thomas." He cocked his head.
"Pretty good, huh? I see you got my message."
"Eventually," I told him, pointing to the book. I should have guessed sooner.
"Didn't Victoria tell you?"
"She thought it was a letter." Of course, now I realised there'd never been a letter. There'd been a carefully placed book and a carefully marked poem, a buried bust, a hidden chair.
"Ah, semantics. It was more of a message, dressed up like a conjuring."
"Yes." I felt relief now, and in it, I could feel the hidden tension in my body easing up. "And now I know why it didn't feel like you were gone."
"Exactly."
His eyes sparkled like pools of ink.
"I'd never leave without saying goodbye."
I felt nothing at his funeral but those words, "leave" and "goodbye," hit me like rocks. "But why leave at all?" Thomas picked at his wing with his beak.
"We've been here a long time. I'm ready for something else."
Now I was feeling even more of my emotions. Fear that tickled and anger that reared up without warning. I waved my hands at the room. "You spend most of your time locked away here in this little town, this microcosm of reality here. How can you be ready?" He paused and looked away.
"I just am."
Then his eyes met mine and were steady.
"I supported your decision to leave and see the world. To stay young and steer clear of your roots here."
He didn't say the rest, but he didn't need to. He had supported all of my decisions because he was my brother, and he respected my autonomy. I nodded. "You're right, of course."
"And we know there was something before all of this. They found us on the mountain, and time has proven that we're more than misplaced children or lost orphans. So I'm certain there's something after. Maybe a moving forward, or maybe a coming home. I want to see that."
I thought the words and wanted desperately not to say them. I failed, because now I knew that the loss I'd not felt before was only delay in its coming. But what about me?
"I don't know about you. We came here together, I know that. But I don't think we need to leave together."
He hopped from the statue to the counter.
"Maybe you'll catch up to me when you're ready."
He paused.
"I only know about me, Michael. I'm ready to go see what's next. What about you?"
I sighed. "I don't think I'm done yet." I looked at my hands and the fine dark hair of my forearms. "I'm not even ready to let my body age." Thomas's chuckle was more of a cackle.
"That one took some getting used to. The weight and wear of time's passage on the body and the mind, shuffling off the mortal coil at long last."
I shuddered at the thought of it, and yet here he was. "So the raven was your idea?" He hopped back to the statue and held his wings out.
"It felt right."
And it suited him. I still didn't understand exactly how he'd done it, or why he was going, but his words rang true. It felt right, for him at least. And my next question was more for me than him. What's next, then?
Oh, I thought we'd catch up a bit here and then take a trip.
He chuckled, and it was the caw of a hungry predator.
Obviously, you'll have to drive.
No, I said. I mean for me.
Ah.
Thomas waited and watched me for a moment.
You'll know when you know. But I can tell you, I have no regrets about my life here in Bradley. None. I saw enough of the world. The best part of it was the ones we met the first time we set foot upon it. My tribe here in Bradley.
He cocked his head.
And you, of course. But I've known you for all my lives.
More truth. I can't remember anything before the day that Reverend McKay found us naked and wandering in the snow. But I know in my bones there were other mountainsides, other findings, and that someday it would be time for my brother and I to leave this place and be found all over again. Maybe in that life I would stay in one place and he would wander, or perhaps do some of each together. Until now I'd never questioned our choices, but the sorrow of his departure weighed on my chest heavy as a boulder. I wish I'd spent more time with you in this one. I wish I'd known you were planning to go. Bargaining come early as grief finally reared its head.
I didn't want it to be a spectacle. I wanted a quick, simple goodbye the night before.
I nodded, after it was too late to talk you out of it. More laughter like fingernails on a slate.
Exactly.
We drove in moonlight and starshine until the forest swallowed us. I turned off the headlights and let my senses guide us, window down, onto the gravel spiderweb of roads leading up into the foothills. My brother clutched the passenger seatbelt with his talons, beak pointed out the window. We were quiet as we went. We'd done all the catching up we needed to. As we went, the forest came to life around us. Bears and elk and coyotes and bobcats formed their ranks on each side of the road. They knew us here for who we were, unlike the others, and we drank their adoration as we remembered briefly where we came from and how we mattered in the slow-moving wheel. The mountain that was our mother on this plane loomed above us, and I felt her call upon my brother. It was a gravity flooded with joy, and I knew I could expect the same when it was my time to follow. We parked and stepped out into the cold. The ground here was white and crunched beneath us. A light snow fell, and I could hear each snowflake singing, a billion-voiced choir in the night as they drifted down. I walked as my brother flew ahead through the trees until we found the clearing. I went to the tree right away. It had grown in the decades and decades since I'd last seen it, but I found the markings and ran my hand over the initials we'd carved there so long ago.
So this is it,
Thomas said. He hopped onto a fallen tree that rotted on the edge of the clearing.
I trust your judgment on the store, but I hope you'll make sure Victoria is taken care of.
I offered it to her the other day. She said no. He chuckled. Then he was quiet, and the silence settled over us.
I'm going to miss you,
he finally said.
But hopefully I'll see you soon.
We're the Found Brothers, I told him. We'll find each other.
Over and over again,
he replied. Evermore, I told the raven. Evermore. There was that raucous laugh again. This time I joined him.
Good one.
Thanks, Thomas.
You're welcome, Michael. I sure do love you.
I sure do love you too. See you soon, eh? With that, my brother lifted off into the air and beat his wings against a sky that refused to hold him down. He flung himself upward at the moon and stars, and the veil of cloud, and the mountain that awaited. He flung himself at all of that, and he flew free across the night's Plutonian shore. I watched until I knew that he was gone, and then I sat in the car and let grief begin its work in me. I drove in the dark, alone with my tears, and paused at the cut-off to Bradley. I had an apartment, nearly empty, in Vancouver, and any number of ships to work. I could have my bag packed and be back on the road before Victoria arrived to open the shop. I could call the attorney, Sandra Matthews, and arrange for the stall to be sold and for Victoria to be retained. Or, like my brother, I could decide it was time for a change. I could pack up my few belongings, move south, and take on the store. Maybe even write a book or two of my own about my life here. And then, when the time was right, follow him up the mountain for whatever world waited beyond. I don't need to know right now, I told the empty car. For now, I had a store to finish cleaning, days to spend in the smell of dust and paper while I made up my mind. The bakery was open when I hit town. The coffee was hot and the donuts were fresh. I bought a dozen and realized as I climbed back into the car that the snow had followed me down from the mountain. I watched it settling upon the shoulders of the statue of Reverend McKay. I listened carefully, and far, far away, I thought that I could still hear it singing. I wondered if it meant my brother had been found again, if the cycle had started up again. I wondered where and how I would find him and myself be found again. But I knew that I would learn all this soon enough, when it was my time to follow.
The cast of characters for this story includes Graham Dunlop as Michael Found, Wilson Fowley as Thomas Found, Renee Chambliss as Victoria, and Julie Holverson as Sandra Matthews. Music for this production was by Kevin MacLeod. So there you go, there's Ken Scholes' Evermore, I Told the Raven. Brought to you by the generous donors of the Kickstarter campaign. Before I get into the specific thank yous, I did want to kind of give an author's note. I don't typically do that for the show. I just typically run the story and then talk about things. But this one, I think, deserves an author's note. It was an interesting experience for both Ken and I in getting this story written and published and brought to pass. Interestingly enough, Orson Scott Card's Intergalactic Medicine Show was also interested in running this, and they'll be running it on their magazine later this month. So that's an exciting thing, especially for me. You know, I talked about this a little bit on my side podcast, Strewn Along the Path, where I was answering questions from Rich Outfield that he had about the podcast and the start of it. But just briefly to sum it up, it was Intergalactic Medicine Show that introduced me to the idea, the concept of podcasting. John Joseph Adams had a column on there, and he talked about different authors like Cory Doctorow who were running podcasts, reading their stories. And also to one of the first attempts for like a paid subscription type of podcast magazine called Mech Muse. And I believe I've talked about Mech Muse before and some of the great stories that I heard on that. But that introduced me to podcasting from there. I just jumped in headfirst. I was kind of a podcast junkie, fiction podcast junkie. and I still am, I guess, maybe in a little bit different way. But through there, I listened to Escape Pod, which played a couple of Ken's stories. The first of which I've talked about before, was Edward Bear and the Very Long Walk. And so I've become a fan of Ken's work. You know, I worked on other podcasts like the Doonsteep and the Drabblecast or Dribblecast. And eventually, you know, I've branched off and started my own podcast here, and it's been running for several years. And for me, at least, it's been successful, and I and a few people have come along and enjoyed the ride, and I'm grateful for that. And then, you know, you already know the story about how this story came to be, how I ran the Kickstarter and asked Ken to provide this Poe-inspired tale for us that we just heard today. And now that story is going to be run on Intergalactic Medicine Show. So it's kind of a full circle kind of a deal here, and it's kind of neat to be a part of that. But that's kind of my side of things and how this has all come full circle for me. But I'm going to read you Ken's thoughts and struggles with this story. So here's Ken's author's note for this story. He says, "I remember chatting with Marshall back and forth a bit as he was putting together the podcast for Of Metal Man and Scarlet Thread and Dancing with the Sunrise. I'd loved what he had done with The Boy Who Could Bend and Fall." Actually, I need to give credit to Christopher Monroe, who did most of the production on that and did a great job. But Ken continues, "So when he started talking about his work around Poe and asked if I'd be interested in writing something original for his Journey Into podcast, my ears picked up. You see, after reading Bradbury's essay, How to Keep and Feed a Muse, and discovering that I indeed had to grow up and be a writer, I took his words to heart. Read poetry every day. And the first poet I fell in love with was Poe, of course. And the first of Poe's poems that I fell in love with was The Raven, of course. There was never really a question which work of Poe I would pay tribute to. It was a hard, dark time. My close friend, Jay Lake, had died just months earlier, and I knew, just like I knew which poem, that the story would center heavenly around that loss. What I didn't know was just how hard this story would be to land. Still, I said yes, I signed my contract, I waited and watched as the Kickstarter funded quickly, and then I got to work. Typically, my short stories come slipping into the world over the course of a week or two. And normally, there's just the one take. I sit down to start the story, and I finish the story I started with. Then I revise it to taste and send it to its new home. Not so in this case. Evermore, I told the Raven, resisted me at every turn, or I resisted it. Early on, I thought I would draw from the well of nostalgia, so I went home to the Buckley Enumclaw area that I grew up in, at the foot of Mount Rainier. I spent a few days saturating myself with old friends and the towns I used to wander. I brought my leather-bound collected works of Poe with me. It was a good trip. I put down a few paragraphs about a brother driving home for a funeral. And then it all got crazy. The story I was finding didn't feel right. So over the course of the next 4 months or so, I found myself starting and then tossing not one or two or three, but seven different starts. AI, virtual science fiction, colony science fiction, near future post-apocalyptic, all with the Raven flying through their midst. None of them felt right. In hindsight, I really just needed to accept that nothing was going to feel right or be good enough when it came to honoring my dead friend. Because in the end, the tribute was more about Jay than Poe, though Poe became a great focusing point, especially in that first poem of his that I'd read and loved. The one about looking for surcease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore. In January of 2015, I returned to Chicago for the PTSD treatment I talked so much about. And with the monkeys quiet, this story settled down too. And in April, I found myself going back to the first attempt, a brother driving home for a funeral. And over the course of the next 3 weeks or so, Evermore, I Told the Raven took shape. I finally wrapped it and turned it over to Marshall to start production, grateful that he liked what I had finally delivered. Of course, that left the print rights available, and a brand new story in need of a home. It was serendipitous that I bumped into Edmund Schubert online about that time, I had not published at Intergalactic Medicine Show since 2007's The God Voices of Settlers Rest, and I had this shiny new story. I had no idea of Intergalactic Medicine Show's influence on Marshall, that the column he'd read in Intergalactic Medicine Show had eventually introduced him to my work over on Escape Pod. So imagine my delight when I learned about this circle we're now completing. I love it when a plan comes together. So this one is for Jay, and my other pal, Edgar Allan Poe. And of course, for you. I hope you enjoy it. And hey, read poetry. Read poetry every day. And that was, of course, by Ken Scholes. So I think that's kind of a neat story behind the story. And this has been a pleasure to work on. There's definitely things that have gotten in way of the production. And as you heard Ken talk about, there were definitely things that got in the way of writing this story. But here we are now. You've heard the tale. It's a good one, at least in my opinion. And I hope you enjoyed it. You know, when I first read this story, I guess I should have understood that it was about Jay Lake and his passing and his relationship with Ken. But I was really intrigued by this notion of the immortality of these two people, and that they would come in and out of each other's lives, and they would just go from one stage or one world or whatever to another. And I like how Ken doesn't give us a lot of detail about that. It's just kind of this thing that they know about. And obviously there's things on this earth, like the animals that came to see Thomas off and things like that, that understand these universal things or these eternal beings that go from world to world. And it was just kind of a neat thing. And actually, it kind of made me think of Wolverine and Sabretooth. Especially, and ironically, I guess, as portrayed in the movie X-Men Origins Wolverine. You know, the relationship between Logan and Jimmy, and that they were brothers and they both had this mutant ability and they fought together in wars and were always there to protect each other and be there for each other. And even though they went down different paths, they still had a strong bond and a strong relationship. And it's not the same relationship that Ken has in this story or that Ken had with Jay. But just that, you know, because in essence, you know, Wolverine or Logan is an eternal being. You know, he heals very well and he's going to be around for a long time. And so that was interesting. And it also, I'm getting back on the subject of superhero movies, but it also made me think of Hancock, which I think I liked better than most people. Most people don't talk really well about Hancock, but I thought it was interesting because there too, you had these two eternal beings or these godlike beings that had these, what we would refer to as superpowers. But they were more like gods, and they had this relationship, and you know, the closer that they got together, the weaker they were. So anyway, just had those kind of mass media thoughts about this, but it brings up interesting concepts about eternity and about relationships that we'll have possibly after we leave this earth. And some go before and some will go after us. And for religious people like me that believe in an afterlife and believe that life is eternal, just on a different plane of existence, you know, it ties into that as well. But, you know, not specifically. I like how Ken left it very general. And, you know, it could be a science fiction take. It could be almost a religious take. It could be just, you know, multidimensional type of thing. We don't know. And they don't really know. They just know what they feel, and they know what they know. And they were found here upon the earth. I liked that device too, how they were the found brothers, Thomas and Michael found. And they had this relationship with this old priest who had gone on. And it was just a really touching story. I liked the representation of Victoria as well. I thought she came across really well, both in the writing and in Renee's portrayal. A lot of good stuff about this story, and it just feels Right. You know, it feels good. It's a different type of story than I would have come up with the Raven. And I liked the little references to the poem. And it was knowingly referenced by the people in the story. You know, it wasn't this thing that where Ken was trying to be crafty and put on all these references to the Raven as an homage, but it was directly referred to by the characters. You know, Thomas loved Poe, and Michael knew of Poe and was reading him. So he was reminiscing about his brother, and he was kind of grappling with why didn't he feel more sorrow. Yeah, I thought there was a lot of humor elements to it too when Thomas came in as the Raven, and instead of saying nevermore or something like that, very severe, he's like, ta-da! And I thought that was really good. I really thought all the voice actors did a really good job. Graham, as the main narrator of the story, as I was reading the story, I knew that Graham would do a really good job with the narration. It would really catch the emotion and the uncertainty that Michael was going through. And I didn't think that Graham's Australian accent would be a problem, because these characters were not from this world, even though they were found in the Northwest and they were raised in America. Michael had been all around the world and had been to, you know, everywhere, Australia, England, Europe, Asia, Africa, everywhere. And so he probably wouldn't have the North American accent. And so I felt good with that, and I really like the emotion and the richness that Graham provided for that role. And as I was trying to think of who could portray a Raven, the voice of a Raven, and also maybe put a little bit of accent in there as well, just to make him similar to Michael, I thought of Wilson Fowley, who's narrated so much good stuff for the Escape Artist podcast, primarily Podcastle, but I believe he's also done Pseudopod and Escape Pod. I'm not quite sure, but I've always enjoyed Wilson's acting abilities and his ability to do different voices. And he did a great job as well when he did Red Road by David Mark Hurtley on the podcast here. And of course, I always think of Squonk from Escape Pod when I think of Wilson. And all the different characters that Squonk the dragon deals with, and that was a really fun story that he did, and he does great with different voices. I thought it turned out really well, and Renee Chambliss, as always, does a fantastic job. She kind of captured the shyness and the uncertainty of Victoria, and you know, she was kind of struggling as well with Thomas being gone and didn't quite understand this Michael character, but she was friendly and nice and helpful, and it's just like Renee. She's friendly and nice and helpful as well. Once again, I'm sorry to Julie Holverson that didn't get her a more media role, but she had just done Amid the Steep Skies Commotion not too long ago, so she had the title role in that. But she always does a really good job and very sharp. All right. Sorry it's taken me so long to get to the thank yous, but I did want to thank every person that donated to the Kickstarter that made this story possible. And so I'd like to thank Rish Outfield. I'd like to thank Hugh Blair. I'd like to thank Joel Pearson and James Mostly Harmless and Craig Christiansen and Jennifer and Shale Haman. Shale or Sheil Haman, I'm not sure which. I'd like to thank Christopher Monroe. I'd like to thank Hugh O'Donnell and Gino Moretto and Bria Burton. I'd like to thank a couple guys from my previous job, Chad Conan and Kevin Katz. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. I'd like to thank John Hyam. I'd like to thank Donna Bernard. I'd like to thank John A. Pitts, who I actually heard read some of his stories at one of the CEFWA readings in Portland, and I know he's a good friend of Ken's, so thanks, John, for that. I'd like to thank Keith Teklitz and Wilson Fowley. Not only did he contribute his voice to the production, but he contributed money as well, so grateful for that, Wilson. I'd like to thank Abigail Hilton for supporting this Kickstarter and making this possible. I'd like to thank Jeremy Carter and Keith Rainey, another friend of mine that I used to work with. I'd like to thank Mike Bassett. And, of course, Dave Thompson and Tom Tancredi. I'd also like to thank Jonathan Lego and Herb Petro for their contributions to this story. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. I'm so grateful to you for giving me the means to be able to contract a story from Ken and to get this beautiful story that means a lot to him personally and means a lot to me as well. So definitely go check out Intergalactic Medicine Show's next issue. They have a lot of good columns on there. I know Lauren Harris has a column on there, which is really good. And so there's another reason. But they have great stories. And there's a lot of great science fiction and fantasy to be found there. As far as getting prizes out to everybody, I have done several of the voicemail clips. Some of you have opted out of that. But there's a few of you that haven't gotten back to me with what you'd like for a little 5-minute audio clip. I've enjoyed doing the ones that I did. I was able to help out with a birthday greeting. And I was able to help out promoting an anthology book that was coming out. And so it doesn't have to be a voicemail message. It can just be anything, a little audio 5-minute production that you'd like. So get in touch with me. I'll probably be reaching out to you via email and things like that. But so I still have a few of those rewards from the Kickstarter to pay back. Tom, I haven't forgotten about your 5-minute audio production. I have a lot of that ready to go. I just need to put it all together. So, yeah, if you can bear with me with that. I haven't been able to work on a bookmark yet, but I will be working on that. And I'll probably send those at the same time that I send out the DVDs of all of the Edgar Allan Poe stories that I've done here on the podcast so far, including this story and including the other ones that will be coming up in August. I've reached out to some people that are going to help me make that DVD possible, but then I've just haven't been able to get back to actually providing them what they need. And of course, I had to finish producing this story and the others coming out next month before I could do anything with the DVDs. So bear with me. I thank you for your patience. I think this month was when I was supposed to have all of that to you, but I will be working on that, sending out the bookmarks and the DVDs. I was able to send out the jerky for those people that were super, super generous. And because I knew, because since I was moving, I knew that to try to make beef jerky and find things when they were packed away. And I wanted to get that done before we left our old house and moved. So I was able to get the beef jerky out to those who were super generous in their donations. I also owe 3 people some stories, and I've gotten some great taglines for that. So anyway, I'm grateful to everybody that listens to this podcast, grateful for Ken for providing this story for me, and I'm just grateful for the opportunity to honor Edgar Allan Poe and to produce this podcast and to continue to have fun doing this. So I'll be back in a couple weeks. I know I'm already late on A Journey into History, so I need to work on that. I have some other good Edgar Allan Poe goodness coming your way in August. So I love y'all. Until next time, stay safe out there and journey on.
Hi, this is Keith. I'm here to tell you that the Journey Into podcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. This means that while you cannot change it or sell it, you are encouraged to share it however and with whomever you would like. The theme music for the podcast has been provided by Man in Space.